The Vintage Gamer, Episode 30, Interview with Eric Goldberg.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. Each week, I usually take a look at a game from the past, either a board game, card game, role-playing game, or computer game. And if you'd like what you hear, you can download more great episodes or even subscribe at www.thevintagegamer.net. This week, as with the last episode, I'm presenting another interview from GDC, and as I just alluded to, it has been a while since the last episode, but I'm going to talk a bit more about that at the end of the show. Right now, I'd like to cover some news about various vintage games coming back into print. Since it has been a while, you've probably heard or read about a lot of these already, but just in case you haven't, it's hard to say which one of these, the first two, is the biggest news. I guess I'll cover them in chronological order. There was a quote kind of buried deep in one of the forum posts from Peter Alatka. He was talking about the rights to Cosmic Encounter. And originally, Fairplay Games was supposed to publish Cosmic Encounter, and that deal fell through. And he says, "But another publisher has made an offer to republish Cosmic and Borderlands, which is another EN game, and a surprise mystery game. More later. No more notice, as far as I know, on who that publisher is, when that publishing is going to happen, and what that surprise mystery game is. There's been some speculation that that game might actually be Dune, which would be pretty exciting. In particular, this came up when Valley Games announced that they had another big game that they're going to be republishing. Now, of course, they're already republishing Hannibal, Rome vs. Carthage, and they've republished Die Macher as well. Well, it turns out that the big game they are publishing is not, in fact, Dune, but is Titan from Avalon Hill. They're also republishing Republic of Rome and Martin Wallace's game Liberté, and some other games that they mention on their site. So all that is pretty exciting. Lots of people were very excited about Titan. A game that you can actually hold in your hand is Can't Stop. I covered that game back in episode 7, and that is finally out with the original stop sign board, like it was originally done from Parker Brothers. That is out from Face to Face Games, and I actually went down and got my own copy. And it is awesome to actually have the stop sign and move the pieces up and down. And it was fun building a game out of playing cards, but I don't know. It's nice having just the board. Let's see, what else can we speculate here? There was a recent thread on Board Game Geek about the acquire rules. Somebody from, can't remember if it was Hasbro or Wizards, was asking the Board Game Geek people their opinion of what seemed to be a loophole in the current, or at least the last published, Avalon Hill rules. This led to some speculation that the game might actually be republished by Wizards or some other imprint of Hasbro. I'll just throw my hat into the wild speculation and say, well, maybe they're also considering a computer version that will be released on Xbox Live Arcade, just like you can play Settlers of Catan and Carcassonne. And something I won't speculate about is Return to Dark Castle. The news is there that the game is finally done. They've completed it. And right now they're just trying to clear up the rights so that it can actually be published. So hopefully that will be out sometime soon, assuming that they can work out that deal. And finally, some news which is completely unrelated to reprinting games is that if you've been to the website, you've seen some postings I've given about a computer role-playing game series done by Matt Barton. And he's completed that. He's finished part three that was originally released on Gamma Sutra. And you can actually read it without registration on his site, which is www.armchairarcade.com. And on top of that, he has some news on armchairarcade.com that he's coming out with a book. He's worked out a deal with AK Peters. So that should be pretty interesting. There are a good bunch there at AK Peters, so I look forward to that. A lot of that is a lot of good news on older games becoming available again, and hopefully this trend will continue. Well, as I said earlier, tonight is another GDC interview show. This time it is Eric Goldberg's turn, and I've already covered two of Eric Goldberg's games on this show. There was Dragon Quest in show 22, and Tales of the Arabian Nights in show 28. He is also well known as a designer of the RPG Paranoia, as well as president of West End Games during some of their most productive and creative years. These days he serves on various boards of companies involved in mobile gaming and presents at various conferences on the same topic, which is one of the reasons he was at GDC. He's actually been a long-time attendee of GDC, or the Game Developers Conference. So, with that, and not much further ado, we'll get to my interview with Eric Goldberg right after this brief message. I will warn some people that there are some bad words, but I bleeped them out, so hopefully this will not offend anyone.
This is Ray.
Sup?
Let's listen in as Ray hits on Sandra.
Excuse me, miss, but do you know karate? Because your body is kicking.
Now, let's listen to the same scene. Only this time, Ray is sporting a quality Geek Label t-shirt.
Yo, baby, I was wondering,
Damn.
Rejection.
What's up with that?
We can't really stop it.
Damn.
But we can outfit you in buttery smooth designs for geeks, gamers, and tech heads. They're custom t-shirts. They're not magic t-shirts.
Damn.
Another fine product from geeklabel.com.
Hello and welcome to The Vintage Gamer. I'm here at GDC 2007. Eric Goldberg, designer of games such as Dragon Quest and Tales of the Arabian Nights, which I already talked about in this show. So welcome to The Vintage Gamer.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Yeah, that's great. So we're looking over the list of games that I found here, and you had some comments about Hunter.
Sure. Hunter was originally designed, or rather was released almost as a game design kit by Creative War Games Workshop, which did it with a fellow named Vincent Sau. When we acquired the rights Lock, Stock, and Barrel, we did a thorough redesign. So if you look at it, the card set is completely different. The rules include substantial differences. It is Vincent's brainchild. It was a wonderful conceit. And I was just very pleased as somebody who had, I did it together with Ben Grossman, who had played the game perhaps a couple hundred times, and several of those times with me, and we were able to take what was a brilliantly flawed game and turn it into a brilliantly polished game. And in terms of design credit, Vincent gets most of the brilliant and I get most of the polish.
Okay.
To be fair.
Well, why don't we go back to the beginning? How did you first get interested in games in general?
First interest in games or first interest in adventure games?
I guess games.
As a child, my parents did not play games, but I had a brother 15 months apart from me, and we played Stratego. I think Stratego is certainly a popular game. All the obvious ones, Monopoly. I was a fan of Clue, and so on and so forth. But I wouldn't say that I was a rabid game player. I did have a real talent for math, and there is a fair correlation between math and games. When I was 12, a cousin came in from the Midwest and said, I grew up in New York City, and said, there is a company called SBI, which does something called playtesting on Friday night. And I've always claimed that my cousin Jonathan led me into the path of ruin that I have followed to this date. He asserts that he only pointed me in the direction. Everything else I did on my own. But it was terrific. They played games in prototype, and at 13 or so, I had a talent for playtesting in that I really enjoyed breaking the system. That was valuable in their culture, because you always want to find out what the mistakes are in the game before it comes out. So they had one of the lesser SBI titles, I think was called, it wasn't called Spitfire, it was an air combat game, and there was a trainer scenario with the Polish Air Force against the Luftwaffe in 1939. You know, it was basically you find out how the mechanics work and the Polish airplanes all get wiped out very quickly. Well, using the rules as written, I took the Luftwaffe out as the Poles, and at that point, they decided I had the right mindset to be able to do this. I then took a job along with a couple of other people who became designers, like Greg Kostikian being the most notable, doing clerical stuff. And shortly before I turned 17, I was offered a job as a game designer. This took me about 2 nanoseconds to consider what to do. You know, get paid to design games, get not paid to go to school. I must say my academic career proceeded to suffer fairly from there. And Jim Dunnigan, the president, was almost equally thrilled because a designer working slightly above the minimum wage. Yeah, so this is a good thing to do, cost control.
Everybody wins.
He thought so.
So I went on Board Game Geek to look up some of your games. Was Highway to the Reich the first game that you
Highway to the Reich, I did the when I was a playtester on Highway to the Reich, and you know, SBI tended to get things out on the schedule.
Right.
Highway to the Reich got out too early. Jay Nelson, the designer, came up with a lot of good mechanics. It was very clear that Highway to the Reich had problems, and one of my first assignments was, because I knew the game thoroughly and Jay had separated ways with the company, was that I was asked to do the second edition and make the rules, make the rules understandable and playable and so on and so forth.
Okay.
But the first game that I was formally involved with was War of the Ring, SBI's Lord of the Rings game. And I was there were two reasons. One was I was the ombudsman for Tolkien, so that meant I made sure that, you know, that they, the fact that I'd read Lord of the Rings, just like most good geeky guys, and that I cared about spelling Lothlorien correctly and getting which they knew mattered. They knew that their audience included a lot of other people, a lot of other people like me.
Have you played the new Fantasy Flight?
No, I haven't.
It's not based on you.
No, I know. I mean, Lord of the Rings has had a number of instantiations. I hear there were some movies recently that did okay.
Yeah, two or three.
Right, or something like that. No, I did Lord of the Rings. The game that I was given as an original design was Descent on Crete, which was the first one that I was asked to do. And Descent on Crete, I was left to be both designer and developer, which is, no matter how talented or precocious I may have been, was a huge mistake in terms of the product. What I say about Descent on Crete is that the best thing about my rookie game is that it's no longer in print, and my tremendous rookie mistakes can't embarrass me. That's not actually fully true at two of the more recent the two most recent companies I've ran. Whenever the staff wanted to annoy me, they would threaten to buy a copy on eBay and wave it in my face. And by the way, at one of them they did, and they expensed it under their research budget just to add insult to injury.
Just so people can understand, can you distinguish between a designer and a developer?
Yes, a designer is the person who comes up with the way, the basic concept of how the game works. That is, if you will, the software instructions to go to your profession, say what the basic principles are. A good developer will contribute to the design, which are the original rules of play and so on and so forth. But the developer is responsible for making it play, for basically making it the most playable, the most fun, and the most deliverable within the schedule.
So basically understanding the production side of things.
Less so. Remember, we're going back to paper games over here. We're going back to paper games over here, and the teams on a project were usually what would happen with the designer and developer would be the only people working on it until it was turned over to the art department. Yes, you would have play testers and so-called blind testers. That is, people who agreed to take. You know, we would make prototype copies of these things and send them out to people to play it, to crap detect it.
Right. Yeah, Steve Jackson just did a talk about that.
Yes, that's right. I ran into him yesterday, and he did mention that he had done some blind testing. I mean, one of the fond memories that Greg and I have is we would do the game maps with Pantone markers, and we were convinced that sniffing the Pantone markers killed a number of brain cells.
So the next one I guess I'd like to talk about is John Carter, Warlord of Mars. That seemed like a rather different title for SPI at the time, having sort of the role-playing elements.
Well, there were two things. One was that SPI does its first fantasy game, science fiction or fantasy game. First of all, SPI, would your audience know who Redmond Simonson was?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay. The two people who founded SPI were Jim Dunnigan, who I think who has a claim to being one of the greatest game, if not the greatest game designer. That's a bit much to do it to one person. But Jim was highly creative and highly prolific. And Redmond systematized things. In fact, there's a whole generation of technical writers who owe it to him about the SPI rule system of 7.62, 7.63. Redmond created a number of systems, and he was a genius for organization. And Redmond did the first two fantasy and science fiction titles. The first science fiction title was called Star Force. The first fantasy title was called Sorcerer, which some of us refer to as color war because that's essentially what it is. He was magnificent on systems. He was not so good on color in terms of background color. Lord of the Rings, that is War of the Ring, becomes the first big title. It sells over 100,000 copies, which made it the bestseller that SPI had ever had. So they looked for they realized that science fiction and fantasy titles could sell, but the company's main old guard, people in their 20s rather than people in their teens, like me and Jim and Redmond, who were in their 30s, really did not have a great sympathy for SF&F. Redmond perhaps a little bit. Actually, ironically, Jim did get into science fiction and fantasy in a way that we would cringe. He would go and see the latest cheesy movie that came out. So I remember he went to see Saturn III, which was Kirk Douglas and Farrah Fawcett on a planet, and a robot falls in love with Farrah Fawcett and tries to kill Douglas and take her away. In any event, that did inspire one of the games that Jim decided to design overnight. But here I was, one of two teenage boys who were clearly completely into playing Dungeons & Dragons. Read science fiction and fantasy with some regularity, and so on and so forth. And so, Greg and I were given Swords and Sorcery,
okay,
which is one of the better games. That's a game I'm very proud of. It is two games in one. we only had budget and time for 1.5 games, so the Quest game is not as finished as it could be. But John Carter was going after the John Carter license was something that that SBI decided to do after the success of War of the Ring. So they asked me to do it. Mark Herman did the combat game. There's a small combat game, and then I did the campaign game. It is a rather Baroque design. I mean, Baroque as in, you know, Rococo.
Yes.
It shows my game design style and talent to the extent that it reflects it. But it also showed that I still could have used an editor, because while it is a very faithful, you know, it was very good for John Carter fanatics, I'm not sure how good it was for people who really were not familiar with the John Carter series. I mean, you can play it and say this is a really interesting game, but the people who loved it to death were the ones who, you know, were the ones who really were into John Carter. And that year I got to do two highly unusual games, that and Commando, both of which were very much departures from the SBI, the so-called SBI style.
How was Commando different?
Well, first off, it was thought of as a role. It was the first role-playing game that SBI did, and once again, it was two games in one. And I did the combat game and the role-playing game, and the role-playing game was underfinished. It is ironic, you know, I've had three games of my design win Best of the Year, and Commando essentially won because the large SBI audience didn't know what to vote for, so they voted for Commando. And there are years where I've had titles that I would have loved to have win lose by one or two votes. I was very disappointed when Swords and Sorcery lost. By literally, it was either one or two votes according to the judges.
That's disappointing.
But those were two games that you look at what my work was in 1979, and they were not typical SBI games at all. And I give them credit for letting me. I mean, yes, I was operating with too little adult supervision, but one of the reasons why I think one of the things that made me a much better game designer, and I still remember this from having received this note 28 years ago, after Descent on Crete was published, I received a note saying, "Dear Mr. Goldberg, I have purchased and reviewed your Descent on Crete simulation, which I find rather interesting. I do see you have a provision for the capture of the Greek King George, which you quite rightly say would have been an absolute propaganda catastrophe for the Allies. For the Greek King Philip. And I note, however, that the last King Philip of Greece was Philip V of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father, who I do not believe was alive at the time of the Second World War. King George, on the other hand, George V, was."
Right.
I felt truly embarrassed, and felt several thousand, actually many thousands of people had paid for that game. Now, SBI should have provided, I was being asked to do postgraduate level research without supervision. Here I was a punk in high school. But I made damn sure when I did my next military simulation that I got absolute world-class help to be able to do this. And it also made me care much more about what was the finished form in which it raised my game. And I tell that story, I tell that story because any good designer has had, maybe not a spectacular, maybe cannot recall it in chapter, but has had something like that cause them to figure out to raise their game.
Right. Next on the list here, I don't know what the order was, but there's Campaigns in Napoleon, there's Dragon Quest, and there's...
Okay. Dragon Quest was the last game I did for SBI.
Okay.
It was a It was a conscious attempt to do a fantasy role-playing game. It is, again, that is a fairly polished game. The one part that is an issue is I was let go by SBI as part of their, as they were getting, they were starting to go into their financial troubles. And the fellow who was one of the two developers on the project, and I had, he had come up with the combat system, which, and that combat system did not particularly, it wasn't particularly good.
This is the first edition?
The first edition.
Yeah.
And it is, to SBI's credit, Dragon Quest comes out, it wins Best Game of the Year, and it wins it from a role-playing game audience rather than from a military audience. And the one thing that they recognized very quickly was that they had to do a second edition with a better combat set. Jerry Klug, he now goes by Chris Klug, even though he was working for the guy who had been the developer who had assisted the combat system, reached out to me sort of undercover and said, can I get your feedback on how to do this right? And the second edition system was not, was not every way I would have done it, but I think Jerry did a terrific job. He had a charge to fix the thing that was just, people did not enjoy the combat system that was left in there. And he polished some of the rest of it and, made some of the other things smoother. Now, unfortunately with Dragon Quest is when SBI collapses in 1982, TSR deliberately retires it as a competitor to Dungeons & Dragons.
So, going back to the redesign, what things would you have liked to have seen done to the combat system that didn't actually get done?
I don't recall, because for me the second edition combat system was relatively close. It was a cousin of the first edition one that I had done that got thrown out. We had playtesting stuff that said that the one that went in the first edition didn't work, but politics are politics.
I think I have to be glad that I encountered the second edition first.
Because they just turned off some people. As it was, based on what happened to the company, it becomes a footnote in history. And eventually TSR decided to publish a third edition many, many years later, but they did it for trademark reasons.
Ah.
It was at least that's the version that John Pickens and Harold Johnson then of TSR told me, and since they said it with a straight face, I believe it.
Oh, yeah.
And they also wanted to slightly D&Dize it, so the third edition is just something that they put capable people on it, but the things that it had laid on it were just too great. There was some very nice supplemental work done for Dragon Quest. One was, there's a great lost edition of Arcane Wisdom, the third supplement,
yes,
which Steve Jackson and John Butterfield worked on.
Okay.
And it was a really nice, it was a really nice piece of work, which was retired. It was literally galleys ready to go to print, but then SBI went down the tubes. Ironically, fast forward 5 years, and there's huge competition. I'm now running Western Games R&D, and Lucasfilm is deciding who to give Star Wars to, and everyone's after it. TSR is after it. Everyone's after it. And one of the things that helped credentialize us is the number two in licensing says, by the way, can I get a copy of Arcane Wisdom? And it turned out that there were two Dragon Quest players in the Lucasfilm Games Group, one of whom is Noah Falstein, who is one of the figures. That was my introduction to Noah.
Right.
And I just said, okay, why is, the people who have the most popular, at the time, the most popular movies in asking me for something that was unpublished. But when we got those Star Wars rights, and they made a conditional on either Greg and or me working on the game, the reason was that the games group said, these guys will do the highest quality product. So that was almost a direct result of Dragon Quest.
Well, I don't know if you're aware, but the arcane wisdom is actually out there on the internet.
Oh. Well, in this case, I could direct him to it. I'm sure it is. I'm glad. It's a nice piece of work. And Steve, I've had the good fortune twice to have Steve Jackson, who I think is, along with Jim Dunnigan, one of the finest designers to come out of this area. I've had the good fortune to have him work on support for two of the role-play games I've done, Dragon Quest and Paranoia.
Nice.
I only wish that Steve didn't have such a successful company that he could do more stuff for Paranoia.
Okay, so TSR, well, I guess SPR collapsed from right off before TSR.
I was let go before the collapse. A year and a half, and in a footnote that's not terribly relevant to your audience, SPI raised some capital, and because I didn't know better, I was able to actually put them in touch with their financing source. And it was in some ways, the most successful interaction I've ever had with the venture industry, because I didn't know what I was doing. Ever since in my later life, I have had dealings with them and worked with a number of companies that are venture-backed. I will say that it was all downhill in terms of the venture industry for them. Anyway, back to just because of time constraints, I want to make sure we cover whatever else you want to hit.
How much time do you have?
I have about 20 minutes.
Okay, yeah, we can do that. So from there, did you do anything between SPI and West End?
Yes. Aside from campaigns of Napoleon, the first Imperium Romanum, where I did Imperium Romanum, the editing / some of the development on the first one, while I was at SPI, I got a permission from Jim Dunnigan to be able to do that, which he thought was pretty bizarre, but he gave it. But aside from that, I then went and decided to do another fantasy role-playing game. And which was the working title of The Complete Enchanter. I was a fan of the Elsprague de Camp and Fletcher Pratt series. It wasn't based on that particular world. And I was not ready to be freelance, and I played perfectionist. I put, after about a year and 3 months on that, it was clear I was, that I was just, I had a couple hundred pages of manuscript. I worked with a fellow named Ted Woods, who came up with a really brilliant combat system, which I regret never saw the light of day, and he's still a little bit pissed off at me about that, which unfortunately, given that in 1981 it would have been quite, or two, it would have been quite, it would have been quite revolutionary.
Right. So from there, I guess you moved. How did you end up at West End?
I go and do my first work with online games and then I do that for about 2 years, and then the then owner of West End said, he said, okay, I've got a vanity press here. It was generating 20,000 to 30,000 a year. He said, I want to turn this into a real company. Just one condition, my fiance is going to run it. And I said, well, he wanted to make a trade with me. He said he wanted my contacts and my design and my design experience in the industry in return for you to do that. I like the idea of getting management experience by having someone else subscribe it. And one of the best things about the West End experience is that the initial crop of people have forgiven me the rookie mistakes I committed on them. But we essentially made a deal where there was pretty much a hands-off in terms of the product development. In fact, we worked out, I said, this is, you tell me what the capital restraints are, so on and so forth. And he actually wanted us to get the Star Wars license. That was what his goal was. I made no promises to do that because it was all locked up at the time and it wasn't free. And I get in there and there are three people, There are three people already there. One of them was a crony of the owner. Two were hired by the fiancé, and they were two very good hires. So while she was not a good manager, well, she was not really a good manager. She was good at spending money, but she wasn't a particularly good manager. I give her credit for hiring John Southard, who won any number of Origins Awards for Best Game of the Year, and then went off to do high-end stuff with Silicon Graphics and so on and so forth. And Doug Kaufman, who to this day, is now at Big Huge Games and was at, and so on. And then I built up a team. We built up the war game thing. And the one thing that I said is, I want to take a risk on a role-playing game. And it's called Paranoia. Part of the condition on signing on with me is I was able to take some risks. And the owner, who had been a playtester at SBI, very much wanted Greg Kostikian and Eric Goldberg designs at the time. So he said, fine, we'll do this, and hopefully it won't suffer too much of a loss. I still remember, there was one day when the art director, who was also ex-SBI, fell off his chair laughing, and the fiancé said to me, you didn't tell me it was funny. We got another piece of hiring luck, a fellow named Ken Ralston, who helped make the tone. So we then started to go out to the distribution network. I remember one of the smartest, most capable people in that network saying, I really like it. It's a bit of adult humor and it will never sell in this audience. We show up at Gen Con. There are two booths in the middle of nowhere, back to back. We can't even get them facing each other. We have 100 and some odd copies of this. They sell out on Friday.
Wow.
At that point, Ken is running it, and you can watch these D&D players discover that the whole paradigm of the party cooperates together is turned upside down, and you don't get information. We then airlift in, every remaining copy that's assembled, and they sell out by early Sunday morning. Harold Johnson kept saying, I want a copy. I said, I'll send you a copy. He said, I want a copy now. So I said, sell me the last copy. So I sold them the last copy. At that point, we had sold more copies on the Gen Con show floor than we had pre-orders from the distributors. And Paranoia suddenly changed the arc of the company, because we suddenly had a hit.
Right.
And then we became a fully diversified line. I had fabulous hiring luck. Paul Murphy, Victory Games couldn't hold on to him anymore, and they gave him to me. Paul's also was at AOL Games, and I think he's either Firaxis or Big Huge. Jeff Briggs, who was the president of Firaxis. I mean, it was just everybody. It was almost amazing that I won't mention the one or two who didn't go on to do it, but it was just, I have never had a run of hiring luck like that. And then we diversified into SFNF board games. For instance, we did Tales of the Arabian Night games, which is one of the games I'm proudest of because I really wanted to solve the problem of interactive storytelling not being a pick-a-path where once you played it, you knew what happened again. Again, Ken Ralston and Doug were that was a fiendishly difficult writing challenge to make it simple and accessible, and it is to their credit that I did the first 100-200 paragraphs, and they had to do the bulk of the 1200, 1300, and they were not easy to do. They were not easy to do to make it a reasonable storytelling. Pointer came out. We also did something that Eric Smith, who was at Victory Games and was also part of the last class at SBI, said that of course you wanted to make West End Games work. We all wanted to do SBI right. So one of the things I did about doing SBI right is SBI had announced that they were going to do a game called AirCav, and a helicopter game that never came out. So we did a game called AirCav with, by the way, the guy who was to be the designer of the AirCav game. But instead of the incredibly complicated Eric Cobra game that your OSG, we made it relatively simple. Now, the designer had some personal issues going on, and we really had to do a last-minute rescue, but it was the best-selling war game that West End put out.
And then, I guess, Star Wars.
Well, Star Wars was the bake-off, and I pretty much sold the story, and by that time, the company had gotten large enough that I had graduated. My last original game for West End, was able to do Tales of the Arabian Nights and Tonto with support. But one of the reasons why, I was very careful I felt that it was important because I was a guy in charge. I had to give credits that are appropriate. So you see me move way down the masthead because it was important. Ken Ralston put it very well. He said, if you do your job right, your job is managing ego food. Because people who are paper gaming designers and developers were paid terribly, so they had to do it because they loved it. And he said, if you do your job right, there will be none left for yourself. And I really was annoyed. Ken just gave me an evil grin because I knew he was right. The best story about that is when it came time for the Paranoid design credit, the basic setting was come up with by a guy named Dan Gelbert, who did not do anything that was published again until the Marvel Superheroes, literally 12, 15 years later. And I went to Greg and said, we've had plenty of credits, we've won awards, we should list Dan's name first, that would be a nice thing to do. And Greg immediately shot back, I don't care where his name goes, as long as mine is in front of yours. Which is why it was Gelberg, Sticky, and Goldberg is why the credit was done that way, and that set a template because the other thing is Greg and I have known each other so well that the rule was always people could always open fire on the boss,
right.
But it also made for a group of people who felt that that they had enough room to make mistakes. I learned very important lessons about working with creative people. So. Star Wars, we get it. We thought that since there was a huge check dropped on them, we thought that was the main reason. No, it turned out we only got the fourth largest. We only get offered the fourth largest check. They made a decision to go with the people they thought they would do the best quality. I mean, obviously the resources of the company were aimed that way, and it is to Paul Murphy's and Ken Ralston's credit that they delivered the Paranoia second edition at the same time, and which was a fairly substantial job. And Star Wars, we enlist people in the industry. I was reminded yesterday that Kevin Ciambita of Palladium, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Riffs, we sent him stuff, and he sends back a scathing note. And then he assumed, and then after, he truly cared about Star Wars. That was something he wanted to see happen. And he gave us comments, including one central thing where he told us what we were doing was completely f***ed. And but then Kevin assumed we would never talk to him again. And I was reminded by one of his colleagues that I spent, the first time I tried to get Kevin disabused of that notion, was I pointed out that he said this was and we changed it because we agreed with him. The second time, I forget what happened. The third time, I finally said, don't worry, Kevin. Even though you told us we were wrong, we knew you were wrong on the other stuff. But we had outside industry help. And we made sure that we did an extensive testing process. We could not supply all the people who wanted to test it. We went out again. It was the centerpiece of that particular Origins because everyone wanted to hear about what it was. It came out at a Gen Con, and I remember Lucasfilm, they now do this all the time, but they allowed us for one of the very first times to use Stormtrooper outfits. And I remember one moment that Greg, myself, and Curtis Smith, who was the head, basically the producer because we were doing several projects at once, the source book, the so on and so forth, got up. We were wired to the gills, and we told people, no, you can't play Imperial characters because of the original edition. And Pete Corliss, who was wearing the full outfit, starts going, you know, going like this at the back, and then everybody turns around and said, "Nope, sorry, we can't play you," without missing a beat. This was not scripted. He just hangs his head in a dejected slump and walks out of the room. We had the audience. The audience was just completely, you know, it was a full room, everyone was grooving into it, and it went out and was, you know, it was a very substantial success. I mean, I forget what the numbers were. I think it sold several hundred thousand. I mean, Paranoia sold, you know, maybe 150, between 150 and 200,000. Star Wars sold more. But the key thing was Greg, in doing the Star Wars design, followed, again, we benefited enormously because of the help of, because we listened to other people. When we came out with the first edition of Paranoia, Warren Spector, and who, of course, is going on to do Deus Ex and now Junction Point Studios, and Alan Varney, who were then running the Space Gamer for Steve, wrote a review saying, "This is a great setting, a great premise," and Alan took a very strong opinion, "but the rules are too complicated." And he took a fairly aggressive view. And when we did the second edition, we said, you know, Alan took, you know, assumed like Kevin that on Star Wars that we would disagree. We agreed with him. So the second edition, we just basically, we had made the systems relatively simple, and we made them even more simple. And it is why the second edition remains a favorite. I mean, I'm very pleased about the modern edition of Paranoia, which, by the way, Alan finally got a chance to do his own version of Paranoia, and it is a thorn in Alan's side that I said, "Alan, I'm going to like the last edition that I got to do. It's not that I don't respect what you do, but you always love your own child, not your adopted child."
Let's move along. I know you're short on time.
Right.
So, after West End, you founded Crossover Technology.
Correct. Online game, and then online applications company. We were best known for doing games. I mean, I had started when I did Videotext before West End. I did the predecessor to Mad Maze, and then for the Prodigy service, which was one of the three leading consumer online services in terms of subscribers, along with CompuServe at AOL, which was the smallest at the time. I did Mad Maze, which was a fairly straightforward fantasy adventure game, and it became the first online game to draw 1 million players. And one nice thing is, whatever the merits of the game are, no one can take away the first from it.
That's right.
No one can take away the first from it. It was, you know, I won't say, I thought it was a quite good game, but it's not one of the best ones. It's not. If I have to name the best designs I've done, it would not be in the top three.
What would be in the top three?
I would probably give Tales of the Arabian Nights would be there. Paranoia would be there, and then I switch. I mean, in terms of games that are important, the Tom Peters Business School in a Box, because it was something where game design, game design stuff was used for a. It was very important for me to apply it to real world use. I think other games that might rate there, Junto would certainly be one of the best games I've been involved with. But I have to say the thing that would put it there is partly Vincent Sal's contribution. Of the SBI games, I would say probably the Command. I would include the Commando, not the role playing part, but the combat part was a fairly elegant piece of work. I mean that's probably where but again, you know, everyone chooses favorites.
Is there any chance of Tales of the Arabian Nights being republished at some point?
I have not put when we republished Tales of the Arabian Nights was republished in Germany, and in fact, for people who get copies of the gorgeously produced German edition, if they could show me a good story, I will send them, because it's a second edition set of rules. Here's the problem, Jim. Greg and I got Paranoia republished, and in some ways that was the most emotionally satisfying thing that I did in 2004, and I did some rather interesting things in 2004 in the mobile game space and in online. But it was the least remunerative of all the things that I did. Arabian Nights, I have. If somebody wants to be proactive, but you know, for instance, just you know, because the second the elaborated, and there's a quite nice job with additional material, with cleaning up some of the stuff in the first game done. It's just a matter of I haven't made the bandwidth to do what we did with Paranoia, which is where we said who's interested. 14 companies said they were, 11 really were, and so on. But Greg and I had to spend a lot of time because we cared. You know, we just care that the quality will be good. So if there is, if there is a publisher interested, my attitude about Tales of the Arabian Nights will be very simple. The same as we were with Mongoose Publishing on Paranoia when we chose them. We said we don't need the best financial deal. And in fact, we basically made a financial term where we gave them something in return. We basically asked them to retain Alan Marty. And Alan was more expensive than who they would have gotten, and we gave that up. So for Tales of the Arabian Nights, it's a great deal of bandwidth for me to be able to do this.
But if someone were to take it on as a developer,
I would. If someone can do a good job with it, the only thing that's unfortunate is when I licensed it to the German publisher, which did a very nice job. Normally, I require, as for instance with Paranoia, that the artwork be assignable to someone else. Under German copyright law, you can't do that. So they'd actually have to. I mean, I know that the Earl Koenig edition people have been very good about when people write to them. They say, we can't give you the first edition, the English language editions, and they're very good about sending things to me by rules that are set up so they don't violate my copyright. And they've been extremely supportive for a game that they had it in print from 99 to 2004. And they continue to be supportive of it nearly 3 years later.
I guess we'll finish up. Do you have any comments about the growth of online games?
I started in online games in 82 to 83.
Sorry, online and mobile games, I guess.
I was in online games too early, and I was in mobile games too early. And I'm very pleased that online games are at the stage where they have, the people who are doing the best work in the field have far surpassed anything that I was able to do, and it's very exciting to see things that I could see in the early 1980s, and I'm very pleased that, for instance, Mark Jacobs, a fellow pioneer with Mythic, was able to exit his company and sell to Electronic Arts, since he was one of the other. There were only four companies from that period. Simutronics is the other survivor. But there's some wonderful stuff being done in online games. Mobile games, we have not had the level of creativity yet because the ecosystem makes it very difficult to... It puts constraints on being able to do original titles. But within 2-3 years, we will see something wonderful. And because the mobile phone is perhaps the most personal devices that people are attached to. There are now, for example, psychiatric recognized conditions which describe your anxiety when you realize you've left your home and you don't have a mobile phone.
Yes.
They are personal, they are ubiquitous, they are communications driven. We will see some wonderful, truly mass market games done in the mobile phone area, and the online game area, we're going to see the promise of virtual reality, the variations on Snow Crash,
right,
occur, and I'm pleased to have been at the beginning, and to a certain extent I regret that I am not an active designer and have not been for about 10 years, but I've been pleased to play some part in enabling the truly great designers who are operating in both media today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Yes, thank you for your time.
Hey, everybody. I wanted to tell you about this great podcast on role-playing I've discovered called Midnight's Lair. It's these two guys, Luke and Eric from Canada, and they talk about different role-playing genres and give in-depth reviews of game systems, They even have regular extras like the Cruel Humor segment, which features a different gamer joke every week, and Gaming Ether by Doc Holliday. He talks about what gamers can learn from old-time radio dramas. I tell ya, these guys really know what they're doing. Listen to this.
How do you say that? Is it any or eeny? Okay, let's just do the whole thing over again.
Let's at least stop where we started making sense.
Stop where we started making sense? Or... that sounds appropriate.
Hi, in today's main event, we're going to... I quote, as an aside on a completely different topic, I shouldn't have read that.
Oh, I know now that's not going on the show.
Okay, maybe not, but there really is lots of great talk about role-playing games on Midnight Slayer. Episodes have covered things like swashbuckling, space opera, superhero adventures, and role-playing in horror games. I tell you, the show is first rate. In fact, Eric described it as the,
perhaps the genesis of all modern media. Stop playing and listen, dammit! I'm Eric.
And I'm Luke.
Join us at www.midnightslayer.com.
So, there's another interview done. A few closing comments on that. First, since Greg Kostikian and Eric Goldberg worked together for so long, I found it interesting to get another perspective on many of the same events and games. Hopefully you found it the same. Secondly, I hope the audio quality was a little better for those people who had some problems and complaints the last time. I will say that I do have a lot of problems projecting into a lavalier mic. It's just the quality of my voice. The mic doesn't pick it up very well. So, if I continue doing interviews, and I would like to, I may have to find another solution next time. I tried moving the mic up a little higher this time, and maybe I'll just implant it into my vocal cords. Maybe that'll work out a little better. And now is traditionally the part where I cover feedback, but I'm going to just apologize to those who sent in feedback recently, as I'm simply not going to respond this week. Instead, I want to take a moment to talk about what I've been up to and why the time between shows has been so long. There have been a lot of things going on here at Vintage Gaming Central. I've mentioned Murr's new job at the beginning of the year, and that has changed the schedule around the house. There's also been a lot of traveling due to the Game Developers Conference, Joe Murphy's illness. If you don't know Joe Murphy, he was one of the crew of the Dragon Page, and he died recently, which is a great tragedy. He was very young. And there's also my sister's recent graduation from Pratt, where she did stupendously. I was also, until a few weeks ago, taking woodworking classes Saturday mornings, which ate up about 4 to 5 hours per week. And I'm preparing to do revisions on my math textbook, which has eaten up a little time in pre-preparation, and which will probably take up the next 6 months in actually getting it done. And on top of all of that, I turned 40, which I also announced earlier, which does cause one, whether one likes it or not, to take stock of life and shift some priorities. So all of that has added up to not a lot of time for podcasting. And realistically speaking, I don't see that changing much in the near future. I'm not saying I'm going to give it up entirely. I mean, I still have shows I want to do, games I want to talk about. I just don't know when I'm going to find the time to do it. The book, in particular, is going to eat up a lot of time. So, if you're willing to be patient about when the episodes come out, I will get them out when I can, but the schedule is going to be very irregular, as you've seen so far. So, that, such as it is the current status of the Vintage Gamer. Hopefully, that won't upset too many of you. Like I said, I am not quitting. I don't know when I'm going to find the time to do it. Now, that said, since I didn't get to feedback this week, I promise I will go through and answer my email. I've sort of been putting it off until I get to the feedback. But overall, I do truly apologize for letting that slide. I do appreciate all the feedback I get, and I'm a bit embarrassed at the length of time it's been since I've responded in kind. What else? Speaking of travel, I will be traveling again this weekend, this time to Balticon, which is in Hunt Valley, Maryland, where I will be participating in Geek Foo 100 and another Lance Biggs pod play. And maybe you'll catch me on some other podcasting events as well. So if you're there, please feel free to say hi. I'm the kind of skinny guy with glasses and a goatee wearing a Hawaiian shirt and jeans. Anyway, go to the podcasting events and I'll be around there somewhere. Just look for my name tag, or if you know what Myrrh looks like, look for the really good looking guy talking to her. Now, if you're not going to be at Balticon and you have feedback on the news, this show, or the podcast in general, you can send that via email to vintagejim@gmail.com. Or you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, plus all the usual places that I post or where you can talk to me, Skype, BoardGameGeek, and RPG.net. I will do my best to respond promptly. And with that, I conclude yet another inquisitive episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer will return in a couple of weeks, hopefully, with another game from the past. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.